You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Mary Hankins. Mary's case has been swallowed by time. It's been 71 years since the young newlywed lost her life in her brand new home in a secluded neighborhood nestled in a scenic hideaway suburb. Case files no longer exist, and evidence has long been lost. Investigators have passed, and Mary's case, that once was the talk of the town, has since faded from the town's memory. Investigators ask, can it still be solved? Fountain City is a suburb of Knoxville, Tennessee. In the 1950s, it was a large, unincorporated city of around 30,000 people. Knoxville wanted Fountain City to become part of Knoxville city limits, and Fountain City wanted to be their own city. But eventually, they became part of Knoxville city limits by 1962. Fountain City in the 1950s was the idyllic post-war era town. At the time, in Knoxville, the biggest industry was coal, and the city had a reputation of being dirty in two different senses. One being all the soot that polluted the air, and the other being that those in the city tended to indulge in drinking and, at this time, what they considered sinful behavior. Fountain City, once known as Fountainhead, was considered an escape from all of that. It was a quiet town that was built around gardens and art, with clean air, and the more sophisticated people gathered there. Mary Tabler, 23, and Fred Hankin, 26, were married in Fountain City in November 1946. They were married 4 years when in 1950 they bought their first home together. It was a brand new red brick home on the corner of Crestwood Road and Forest Lane, built in a neighborhood that at the time and still today was tucked away from the bustle of town. By 1951, Fred worked at Chavinus Lumber, and Mary was a homemaker. They had been in their home almost a year and had no children. It was now spring, and the couple was working on their front yard. There were dirt piles sprinkled across the front yard waiting for planting. Saturday, March 31st, 1951, Fred and Mary had been home together enjoying their Saturday working in their yard and finishing things around the house. Later in the afternoon, Mary and Fred sat down for lunch. After lunch, Fred kissed Mary goodbye as she was finishing the dishes from their lunch and headed out to drop off their car at the repair shop on Broadway, leaving Mary at home to finish up her daily chores. Fred would then return home shortly after, dropping off the car, and would help around the house some more and the yard until around 3 p.m. He would leave Mary alone once again as he would go pick up the car from the repair shop, and she would begin dinner that would be ready when Fred arrived home. Fred would stop to visit his father at the furniture store before arriving home around 5 p.m. Mary was in the midst of preparing a chicken when an unknown man would knock on her door. And at some point, he would enter their home. This is a time when nobody locked their doors, and this would forever change that. Fred would return home to find Mary on the floor bleeding from a single shot to her head. She was still alive. Fred called an ambulance and Mary was rushed to St. Mary's Hospital, where she died 30 minutes later, unable to tell anyone what happened to her. This being such a close-knit community, the news spread quickly. I've talked a bit about how the press used to cover the cases in the newspaper before, how most families got more details from the press than the police back then. This was no exception. Based on the news reports, when investigators arrived at the scene, they noted that there appeared to be a struggle between Mary and the gunman. There was blood on the steps that led to the basement garage as if she had tried to flee. There were drips, not splatters, and Mary had a small scrape on her left arm that they attributed to that. There was a dish towel on the couch that faced their large picture window, and her body was found lying in the room that could be seen as you approached the home. When investigators questioned the neighbors, it would be the Hankins' next-door neighbor, Mary Elizabeth Schumacher, that would describe seeing a tall, slim, slightly stooped man in a blue suit and brown hat entering the Hankins' home around the time of the murder. Mary Elizabeth then told officers she saw the same man briskly walk out of the home 25 to 45 minutes later and enter a black 1950 Ford with Knoxville County plates, and he sped away. None of the neighbors ever heard a single shot. Officers believe that the killer used the dish towel found on the couch by Mary's body to muffle the gun, which would explain how and why the neighbors never heard the gun go off. The whole event had caught Mary Elizabeth's attention because she noted that it seemed too cool for a man to be wearing a light summer suit. She said she saw him knock, then enter Mary's home. Friends said that Mary never opened the door for strangers, but Mary Elizabeth noted that it seemed like Mary let this man in with no hesitation. Fred would soon discover that Mary's watch was missing, and he believed that the killer most likely took it. This rocked the community of Fountain City, and everyone wanted answers as investigators launched a very public search for the killer. Investigators had a rough start from the beginning, as the moment Mary was discovered, well-meaning neighbors and family members had trampled all over the scene before they could secure it. They decided right then it would be a waste of time to dust for prints with as many people that had come and gone through the house at this point. Panic would spread across the north end of the county, leaving men afraid to leave their wives and children home alone and housewives terrified to answer the door. Because of the very public search, leads came in quick, but not all of them were as promising as they had hoped for. They interviewed and questioned over 100 people in the first weeks of the investigation. One lead that had some merit pointed to a notorious daytime burglar and jewelry theft named James W. Lawen. He was known to have committed burglaries in Knoxville County and surrounding areas and drove a dark-colored Ford, but they could never fully link him to the crime. Investigators did grill Fred on a few occasions to make sure his story was consistent, and they never found any evidence that pointed to Fred killing Mary. April 2, 1951, Miss Labetti, the wife and the lead detective in Mary's case, would receive a call at home in the afternoon from an unknown caller asking for her husband. When Miss Labetti told the caller on the other line that her husband wasn't home, the caller replied, "Got any ideas where I might reach him? He's working on that murder case, isn't he?" Miss Labetti said the unknown caller went on to warn her, "You might end up with a hole in your head." Miss Labetti went on to assure the caller that she didn't bluff easily and she wouldn't just let him in her door as easily as Mary had. The unknown man replied, "Mrs. Hankins did not let me in easily either." He also told her to tell Sheriff Jones to keep his $100 reward and for her husband to drop the case. The caller then hung up on her. Mrs. Labetti was not only the wife of the investigating detective. Her brother, Raymond Whaley, was married to Margaret Hankins, Fred Hankins' sister. They would investigate this call, but the only description that Miss Labetti was able to give was that he had a common, everyday masculine voice and that he spoke so sincere she found it hard to believe he was a prankster. They never found out who the caller was. A break in the case would come 3 months later in June 1951. A farmer and his son were washing their vehicle on the side of Norris Freeway when they saw something that caught their attention lying in the creek bed. When they came closer, they realized it was a pearl-handled .32 caliber pistol. They brought it to the sheriff's office, where Sheriff Jones would state after examination of the gun that the bullets of this gun matched the bullet that killed Mary. Something interesting about the gun was that it was several decades old at the time, and five bullets still sat in the cylinder chamber where an original six were, with a single bullet spent. The water the gun was found in also had this chemical reaction with the brass, and it had etched fingerprints in the brass casting. But Sheriff Jones was never able to match the prints. He tried tracing the gun owner, but that never panned out either. Mary's murder quickly became political as newspapers that were strong Democrat-leaning and strong Republican-leaning began to report on Mary's case. They used more political discourse when reporting about Mary's case than reporting about Mary's murder and getting her justice, and more about how each side could use the investigation and the fear of the murder to further their political agendas. At the same time, Knoxville had decided they were going to get involved in Mary's case against Fountain City's persistence that they could handle it. Knoxville would conduct its own investigation alongside the Fountain City Sheriff's Office investigation, and oftentimes, they didn't share information with one another. Again, this became which department was going to solve it versus these two departments working along with one another for a common goal of solving Mary's case and finding her killer. There was lots of egos and pride that hurt Mary's investigation early on. Sheriff Jones vowed to never rest until someone was charged in Mary's murder. Editors in one paper would mock Sheriff Jones' vow. The paper started calling him Sleepless Jones. Jones offered $100 of his own money as a reward at the same time as Knoxville Mayor George Dempster was offering cash for tips and leads. Again, politics was at play as Jones was up for re-election. The papers played more to the drama unfolding in Mary's investigation than to Mary's case. They pushed the Sleepless Jones narrative so much that it and Mary's case became the highlights of his re-election campaign. Mary's mother, Mallie Tabler, was so frustrated with the press and the way they were reporting about Jones that she took out a large ad in the Sentinel directed at the Journal and their reporting. It said, quote, "The untimely passing of my daughter Mary Hankins was the outstanding tragedy of my life. Her passing was and is a sacred matter. In my opinion, it is shameful and disrespectful the way the Knoxville Journal has undertaken to make a political football out of such a sacred occurrence. Sheriff Jones and his staff did everything possible to solve the murder of my daughter. They went beyond the call of duty. I have nothing but words of kindness and accommodation for Sheriff Jones." Unquote. About 2 years after Mary's murder, a woman would come forward to Knoxville County Police and tell them that she knew who Mary's killer was because she had ridden with him to Mary's house and watched him talk his way into her house that evening. Jessie Waldrop was a waitress who was an acquaintance of Joseph P. Hegler, a traveling painter and salesman. Jessie said she watched Joseph enter Mary's home and she stayed in the car and waited for him to return. She said after some time, she then saw Joseph run out quickly and get in his car. She said he looked over at her telling her that he just shot a woman and if she opened her mouth, he'd kill her too. Based on Jessie's statements, Joseph would be arrested and brought from South Carolina to Knoxville where he was detained for a week while Knoxville investigators questioned him. Joseph spent an entire week denying having anything to do with Mary's murder. Joseph would obtain a well-known defense attorney, Ray Jenkins, to represent him. Ray was able to convince the magistrate that his client had a solid alibi for the day of the murder, stating that at the time of Mary's death, Joseph was in a North Carolina forest. The case really fell apart when they realized their witness, Jessie, couldn't describe Mary's house accurately, and the payroll records from Joseph's job backed up that he was in North Carolina at the time. He was released and the charges against him were dropped. While Fred was ruled out from the start rather quickly by investigators who felt like they pushed him hard, they were certain he was innocent, but that didn't change the public's suspicion and scrutiny of him over the years. Just shy of a year after Mary's death, Fred would write an open letter to Sheriff Jones in the Sentinel, speaking to what he's dealt with since his wife's murder. He said he knew he was the subject of whispering and rumors, but noted that he always cooperated with Sheriff Jones and that he was willingly fingerprinted, took a lie detector test upon request, and even offered to take truth serum, a drug, thiopental, that was thought back then to make people more willing to speak the truth. He said, quote, "I assure you of my continued cooperation in an effort to solve this crime," unquote. Jones would lose re-election and later move to Florida, and his successor, Austin Kate, took office vowing to solve the case, but he too would fail. No new leads generated any information to help them move forward. Investigators had a hard stumbling block, and that was motive. Fred thinks Mary's watch may have been missing, but it was never confirmed for sure, and with nothing else missing, that leaves the motive wide open. There's real questions with the time frame as well. If the neighbor's account of that afternoon is correct, then an unknown man entered the home and was there 35 to 45 minutes before fleeing the scene. What was happening inside that home? Did they know Mary was alone? Were they shocked to find her alone? There's so many unanswered questions, which makes it harder to find her killer. Throughout the years, investigators would go back and forth with James Llewellyn. As a possibility, and in the 1960s, the Sentinel paper remarked on his latest arrest, and again, publicly questioned if he had anything to do with Mary's murder. James would die without ever being held officially tied to or charged with Mary's murder. As the years went on, Mary's case would fade from the public spotlight, and eventually, Fred would remarry. He was an avid golfer, and his name and score would appear in the papers over the years. He became a founding member of the Beaver Brook Country Club until his passing, just shy of his 80th birthday in December 1999. Over a decade after Mary's murder, the public would be reminded of her murder again, and there would be life breathed back into her case. But as time went on, the world moved on, and Mary's case got completely lost in the shuffle. There are no case records remaining for Mary's case, and all the evidence, including the gun, which was their biggest lead, have long been lost. Mary's case is preserved only in news articles that covered her case, in a chapter book, Murder and Mayhem in East Tennessee, written by Dwayne A. Speaks. He was living in Fountain City as a boy and remembers Mary's murder and how it shook his community, so he included a chapter in his book.
Before that, people didn't even lock the doors. They started locking the doors.
Years before he wrote about Mary's murder, author Dwayne Speaks heard the story as a boy.
Well, I was in the eighth grade, and that's all people in this area would talk about, that Hankins woman, that Hankins murder, because in Fountain City, that was unheard of.
There were many more suspects in the public's eye, but only one arrest was ever made in her case, and that guy had an alibi. The killer has gone 71 years without ever being caught, and Mary's gone 71 years without justice. I won't say a case can't be solved, but this one has more than its challenges. With no evidence and no official records, they're only relying on news articles. I think it's a long shot. But we never know. Maybe one day someone will finally come forward with the answer. Mary deserves that. Thank you for listening to Mary's story. Please share it in any format you feel comfortable in, and just maybe we can shine a little light on Mary's case today. If you're listening on Apple or Spotify, I would truly appreciate it if you would take a moment to review or subscribe to this podcast. It helps others find the show, and it helps get these cases to more listeners. Don't forget when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media to hit share, like, and retweet. Every time we share a face, the closer we get to solving a case. Until next time.